The Honorable Chief Justice Perry Berry presiding.
Go ahead and be seated. Good morning. All right. First matter on our docket this morning is docket number 53126, Picardi versus District Court. And Mr. Bland, are you ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If it pleases the court, my name is Paul Bland, representing the Picardis in this matter.
Would you like to reserve a little bit of time?
I could reserve 5 minutes, if that's possible. That would be great.
Yes.
Really appreciate the court sending out an order that set out the issues that they wanted for us to address. And the first issue that was set out in that order was, should the court follow the majority or the minority rule? And to be totally honest, having studied this area very closely and knowing pretty much all the cases around the country, I think it's hard to say which is the majority or minority rule, because there are a lot of federal district courts out there. There's probably more than 150 cases on this issue, more or less, around the country. But what we can tell is among state Supreme Courts, there's a majority rule, and there is a very strong trend. The Strand case, which was one of the six cases that this court asked us to look at in its order, was decided by the North Dakota Supreme Court in April of 2005. That was the high water mark for the defense bar in arguing that class action bans are always enforceable. Since the Strand case more than 5 years ago, there has not been one state Supreme Court to agree. Meanwhile, there has been six other state Supreme Courts that have looked at it. California in the Discover Bank case, New Jersey in the Muhammad case, Washington State in the Scott case, Illinois in the Kinkle case, New Mexico in the Pfizer case, and Massachusetts in the Feeney case. All six of those courts, 6-0, have found that bans on class actions that are exculpatory are not enforceable and were stricken down. So I would say, I don't know what the majority rule is, but certainly the trend, the majority rule among state Supreme Courts favors us, and we would urge you to follow that. The court asked us to speak to six particular cases. With respect, I'd like to urge that the best and most important of those cases is the Scott case from the Washington Supreme Court. And there's several reasons why that's true. First, the factual record in that case is extremely similar to the factual record in this case. If you look at pages 1003 to 1004 of the opinion, they discuss in some length the affidavits that the plaintiffs had put forward in the trial court, which had been rejected by the trial court and the Intermediate Court of Appeals in that case, but which the state Supreme Court found very persuasive. The affidavit of Peter Mayer, who was a consumer lawyer who handled a large number of consumer cases, are very similar to two of the affidavits that we have here. And the affidavit of Ms. Sally Gustafson Garrett, who had been in the state attorney general's office for many years, is almost identical in its tone and content to the affidavit of Mr. Dan Wolves, who's one of the witnesses who we use. Now, there's been some attacks in the brief of the respondent saying, well, these people weren't qualified as experts, and is this expert testimony or factual testimony? Well, first of all, I think that there's a lot of factual testimony in this. If you look at Mr. Wolves' affidavit, first of all, he testified that legal aid is simply not handling cases of this sort on an individual basis. They do not have the resources. They're focused principally on foreclosure this day, and that's just a fact. Legal aid is not handling these cases. Moreover, Mr. Wolves testified that when legal aid tries to refer cases like this out to private lawyers, the private lawyers will only do it if the consumer can come up with a retainer. And that the reality is that there are no consumers out there who have been cheated out of somewhere between $50 and $1,500, who are able to pay a retainer to a lawyer to go and try and retrieve for them the $50 to $1,500. This is exactly the kind of case where it is either done as a class action or it's simply not going to be done. And that testimony is very strong. Mr. Landish testified that he's handled a great many individual claims against car dealers. He refers cases to other consumer lawyers, has cases referred to him, knows the consumer bar here, has been handling these sorts of cases, and he sets out a foundation from which his expert testimony can stand, explaining how he knows the market of what types of cases people will handle. And he says a lawyer simply will not take cases such as this, having read the complaint, and that there is that the consumers are not able to pay retainers in general. Now, this testimony, by the way, that was in the Scott case, and it's very similar to the testimony here, is completely different from the testimony if you look at the Strand case, which was one of the, which I said was the high watermark of the defense bar. The North Dakota Supreme Court did not actually say that class action bans were always enforceable. Instead, what they found was that there was a failure of proof by the plaintiffs in that case. They said all they did was they came in with an affidavit that said, well, I wouldn't take this case on an individual basis, but it had no foundation and no indication that any other consumer lawyers or that other consumer lawyers would not be willing to take the same kind of case, and thus that it was lacking.
Could you comment for me on the significance of the difference in the attorney fee clauses in the Scott case and in the case at bar?
I don't think that there is a significant difference. The Scott case, the attorney's fee provision provided that a prevailing plaintiff would get their attorney's fees. Actually, I guess the attorney fee provision was stronger for the plaintiff in the Scott case, as I recall.
Well, the Scott case says that the attorney's fees would be awarded only if the plaintiffs recovered at least the full amount of their demand. That's what they say the
I'm
Scott
sorry, I was confusing with the Pfizer case. I apologize. In that case, yes, that is a difference between them. But I think they also argued that there was an argument there that that Singular had made that that the arbitrator had to follow underlying state law, so that if the state attorney's fee statute would provide for attorney's fees, that would still be provided. But that is one difference between the Scott case and this case.
And in this case, the agreement specifically says that the arbitrator, it says that each party shall be responsible for its own attorney fees unless awarded by the arbitrator under applicable law. I don't see that as you do, that it's discretionary with the arbitrator. I think the arbitrator has to follow the law and award a fees if they're recoverable. And so I'm wondering how important that is to your argument that Scott should apply here.
Well, first of all, I think in our brief that the vast majority of courts have looked at this have been in the setting of cases where the arbitration clauses provided that the consumers would get all of their attorney's fees if they would have prevailed under standard law, and that was not significant. It wasn't significant. That was true of the Muhammad case in New Jersey. It was definitely true of Dell's arbitration clause in the Pfizer case. It was true of Discover Bank's case clause in the California Supreme Court. I understand the distinction the court's drawing, but the reality of it is that there is no bar of lawyers in this state who are going to be taking cases of $50 to $1,000 in the hope that they're going to get all their attorney's fees out there. Then the other thing that's significant is the vast majority of consumers will never realize that they've been cheated. The Kinkle case in the Illinois Supreme Court, and also the Scott case, the Muhammad case, drew a very important point, which was that the vast majority of consumers would not have realized that they had been cheated. So as a result, if you look at the case, not just from the perspective of the individual plaintiff, but you look at it from the purposes of the Consumer Protection Act. And the state's, Unfair Deceptive Trade Practices Act is not supposed to get the money back just for the Picardis. It's supposed to stop companies from cheating people and doing baits and switches generally, and you view it from the perspective and from the metric of consumers generally. And if what happens is the defendant's able to cheat several thousand people out of a couple of $100, and then only two or three of them get their recovery, then the purposes of the Consumer Protection Act have been gutted because most consumers never even realized that they were cheated. And that's something that is embedded right in the Kinkle case, which is one of the cases the court asked us to comment on, which I think is very powerful, and I think that's exactly true here.
We also have the issue raised as the single document rule.
Yes.
And there's very little law in that area. How would you think that we should approach?
I think that the statute itself, Your Honor, is very, very clear. I mean, I think that the statute says that every retail installment contract must include the entire agreement, and it's with two exceptions. A is chattel mortgages, and B is repair and alteration to real estate properties. Neither of the exceptions apply. So it says you have to have the entire agreement. And we get the example of the 11th Circuit in the Magnus and Moss setting, where they say that the purpose of having a single document rule is that it's clearer for consumers and everything is pulled together in one place, and that was ground for the 11th Circuit.
Should we look at it as absolute, or should we look at it as a timing issue of how it's presented?
I think that there is an exception there's also an exception in another part of the code that says that the parties later reach a separate agreement, which then becomes the single agreement, has a merger clause or integration clause that pulls it together, that would be grounds for having, if parties come back some point down the road, that there's an exception at that point. But at the point at which parties are presented with, basically the purpose of the single document rule is to avoid exactly what happened here. These people can get 21 separate sheets of paper, and it's one of these typical closings which they go through and they say, sign here, sign here, and sign here.
But Mr. Bland, how is that any different than if they'd been given a single sheet of paper that goes on for like a roll of toilet paper?
Well, I think that there's There's a debate among people who are consumer psychologists and so forth about whether the single document rule is a good rule. And there are some people who think that the Federal Trade Commission shouldn't have adopted it, and they think that Congress made a mistake in Magnuson-Moss. There's some very fine left-wing law review articles that will say that statutes such as Nevada statute are dumb statutes and shouldn't have been passed by the legislature. I personally disagree with that line of thought. I mean, I think that the problem of having people sign a huge number of documents makes it more confusing. What happens is people get into a habit of just signing everything. So I personally think that the policy behind the single document rule is a valid one. But what I would urge the court to say is that here you have a statute. You know, the legislature made the call here. They said you have a single document rule. They said it implies the entire agreement. And they didn't draw any distinction for arbitration clauses are separate. They said the entire agreement. And under that setting, I think that legislature spoke plainly to it. And
well,
even
it looks like the source of the federal of the single document rule is the Federal Truth in Lending Act. If you look at the federal regulations dealing with single document, it appears to tie this to timing rather than a document. Do you agree with that, or would you reject that notion?
Actually, I think the single document rule has a number of antecedents. I think there are more of them in the Federal Trade Commission Act and the FTC law than there is in Truth in Lending. And I think Regulation Z speaks about single document rule differently in different contexts. I think they have a different rule for home mortgages than they have for cars. So I think that's a more simplified description of Regulation Z and the Truth in Lending Act regulations than is fair. But I do think that Nevada follows a similar kind of rule where they say that if you have present people with a bunch of documents at one time, sort of contemporaneously, that is a problem. There's a single document rule issue there. But if you have people sign an agreement and then come back at some point later and sign a separate single agreement that has a merger and integration clause, that's all right. So I think there is a temporal aspect to the Nevada statute that's somewhat similar to what I think Regulation Z would do with respect to truth in lending. But I think the Nevada statute's a lot more straightforward than Regulation Z, which is many thousands of pages long. I would like to hold the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Ben David.
Just bigger. Thank you. Good morning, Justices. Jeff Ben David appearing on behalf of FT Automotive 3 DBA United Hyundai. I think the comment I would start with after hearing the argument is different than what I think I planned on, which is just sign here. The comment that was made was, had it been in one document, and I'll get to the one document in a second, they would have just signed here and signed it anyways. Actually, what we don't have in this case, which is different than every single case that's been cited by myself, cited by the petitioner, cited by this court, is the agreement. No one talks about the agreement. The petitioners especially don't talk about the agreement because they don't want to talk about it. And the reason is it's not a just sign here. It is not a clause that was stuck in an envelope. It wasn't folded up and mailed out to 500,000 or a million people. It wasn't emailed. It wasn't in a 31-page booklet. It was actually an agreement. The Bacardis signed the agreement acknowledging, agreeing, and consenting to it. That's a bargain for exchange. That's a mutual understanding between the parties that they've agreed to this document, that they've agreed to this contract, and signed it. Now, it does get incorporated into the retail and solid contract, the purchase and sale agreement. But what's different from every single case is that you don't have an agreement. You have a clause that's inside a contract, a 31-page booklet, an 11-page contract, a loan agreement, a service contract for a cellular service. None of those address the issue that we have in this case, which is a contract. It's an actual agreement between the parties, and that's the difference. Now, I agree with counsel that I thank the court for providing us that order on oral arguments, identifying the issue you wanted to discuss, and in dealing with that first issue, which is the class action waivers. We would say the petitioners are correct in that the case you should look at and the case that we should follow, because I think it closely resembles Nevada's law now, is Strand. Strand makes clear that, first of all, they are not per se unconscionable. None of them are. What petitioners want you to believe and you to adopt is that every arbitration agreement is per se unconscionable and that every class action waiver is per se unconscionable. I guess if you ask a class action plaintiff lawyer, should class action waivers be allowed, their answer is going to be no. I'm okay with that. I understand that. But what Strand does is Strand does not make them acceptable either. It makes it, it requires the court to review the actual agreement on a case-by-case basis. What Strand says is, A, they're not per se unconscionable. It also says that when you review a contract agreement, an arbitration agreement that included a class action waiver in it, you have to what? Show both procedural and substantive unconscionability. You have to show both. On top of that, the court specifically said, and I wrote this down because I thought it was interesting, was courts are obligated to balance the various factors viewed in totality to determine whether the clause at issue is so one-sided to render it unconscionable. In other words, you have to review it on a case-by-case basis. You can't make an arbitrary decision, say they all are. And who else found this was the cases that was also cited by petitioner, which is Kinkle. In Kinkle, they turned down that arbitration agreement, saying that it was unconscionable procedurally.
But what does the waiver do to access of justice for consumers? In other words, how are they going to go to arbitration over $38 or a small amount of money?
I'll answer that right now. A consumer can go to arbitration. Actually, the consumer doesn't have to go to arbitration. It goes back to the point I made at the very beginning, is that this agreement is different than any other agreement. If you follow Strand and this court decides to adopt Strand as its standard and move forward on that basis, the most interesting part is then you would have to review what's on the record. And what's on the record is this agreement. And I'll tell you right now, there's two issues to address there. First of all, with regards to the cost, what they argue is it's too expensive to go to arbitration on a small claim. What does the arbitration agreement say? It says, we will advance your filing, administration, service, or case management fee and your arbitrator or hearing fee all up to a maximum of $1,500. We will advance, which means the dealership will pay for the first $1,500. So any argument that they can't, that it's too expensive to pay for the arbitration, the dealership already said, we'll advance it. What's the second issue that I think is even more important than that? Because you never even get to the arbitration expense. And second to last paragraph.
Well, but by advancing costs, that doesn't mean we'll pay them. Interestingly, this seems to be a little bit different than the case in Washington, where the arbitration clause there said we'll pay for them, period. Advance sounds to me like we're going to get them back. Well, and if the costs exceed that amount, the consumer is still required to pay them.
That's correct, Your Honor. And just like attorney's fees and costs incurred in filing of an action in district court, the dealership could get that back too.
I think Mr. Bland may have recalled the Washington case correctly in responding to Justice Pickering. There, the facts at least quoted in the case are, on the issue of fees, singular would pay the filing, administrator, and arbitration fees unless the claim is frivolous. And as to attorney's fees, singular would reimburse the customer for reasonable attorney's fees and expenses incurred for the arbitration, and the only proviso is that the claimant secure some recovery. So if anything, it looks like the reimbursement of fees and the right to pay attorney's fees is greater in the Washington case, in the Scott case, than it is in the Strand case. Would you agree with that?
I would.
Isn't that an important ingredient in exculpation, though? For those who say that exculpation doesn't apply, it's largely because there is a cost reimbursement available, and there is a fee reimbursement. So how do you distinguish those two positions in this court's addressing this problem?
I'll address that. It's the equality of it. It's the
I'm
same.
Sorry?
It's the, the equality of it. It applies to both parties.
Uh-huh.
And one of the substantive issues that come down to whether it's substantively procedurally or substantively unconscionable, would be, is it equal? It is equal to both parties. If this action, if you remove the arbitration provision altogether, and you were to file that in district court and not in arbitration, nobody can enforce arbitration, you would still have that right under a prevailing statute. It's based on the law that the action is filed on. What this document does not do is limit the actual remedies, causes of actions, or actions of the parties. This is a procedural document, not a substantive document. And both Kinkle says that, Strand says that, that a class action is not a substantive remedy. It is a procedural right. And if it's a procedural right, then you have a right to waive it, limit it in any way.
Assuming the Hyundai, but hopefully that's not the case, has an accelerator problem, could Hyundai rely on this language to seek class certification in arbitration for the defense of
I think the answer would be no, and I'll tell you why. Because if you're going to sue under a product defect case, you're going to sue the manufacturer. And the manufacturer is not part of this agreement. Mm-hmm. So the dealership cannot force the manufacturer into this agreement, which is between the consumer, the customer, and the dealership. So I would say no. Those class actions are filed all the time, and arbitration provisions aren't even called on unless there's some kind of arbitration agreement with the manufacturer. I think that's a separate issue. But let me address the issue of the small claim, because that seems to be a big point of the petitioners. First of all, with regards to a small claim, there's absolutely no evidence in this record, when you have to review this on a case-by-case basis, that says this is too small of a claim and it'll be too expensive. The one thing they don't have is evidence. There is no evidence in this case whatsoever that this case is too small, that no attorney would take it. The only evidence you have is an affidavit from Mr. West, who I love, wrote an affidavit saying he wouldn't have taken this if this wasn't a class action. But that's not evidence. In Strand, they specifically found that petitioner's attorney's affidavit was not evidence that he wouldn't have taken the case. It is simply, there is no record. And what you don't have is you don't have any testimony, any evidence, any interrogatories, or anything from the petitioners saying, I never even knew I signed this stuff. I didn't know what this was. Because one of the main issues that I keep hearing over and over again, and you read it in the cases, is talk about the small claim amount. The last full paragraph of the arbitration agreement that was entered into in this case says, you and we retain the rights to self-help remedies such as repossession. You and we retain the right to seek remedies in small claims courts for disputes or claims within that court's jurisdiction. So, his $150 claim that they use as an example, that's not this case, it's not a $150 claim, in fact, it's a lot more. But the example of the $150 case would be exempt from this agreement. So the issue of it's too expensive to arbitrate a $150 claim wouldn't apply because it's exempt. It says it right there that they retain the right to keep it in small claims court. And in this state, it's $5,000 is a limit for small claims. So why can't a consumer who do it every day, they're small claims court, every day, and they are filed against businesses every day? They could litigate that $150 case right in small claims court. And it's not limited. And in fact, it is exempt from this agreement.
How does that affect the motion to compel arbitration?
The motion to compel arbitration was based on the fact that they had filed it as a class action. And so we were enforcing arbitration. And I'll tell you the other part it affects is this case was not for a $150 case. There were a number of causes of action, and there was a number of claims that they made with regards to the price of the vehicle. A number. And so it didn't equal $150. It wasn't even close.
So this is not a small claims case.
This is not a small claims case.
Okay. Mr. Ben David, can I ask you about one of our cases, D.R. Horton versus Green, where we held that a home purchase contract, when you had to go to binding arbitration as opposed to having a jury trial, was procedurally and substantively unconscionable. How would you distinguish this case from that? And maybe if you'd focus on the substantive unconscionability issue more than the procedural.
On the substantive portion of that, I would say is this. In this case here, what you don't have is you don't have any evidence that it was a take-it-or-leave-it basis, that they didn't have any choice, that their limited rights were waived by signing the agreement. What you have in the other cases, however, is sites where there's evidence been put into the record that they didn't understand it, they just signed it. In this case here, you have an agreement. And in that agreement, what it says more than anything is that identifies substantively that none of those rights are waived. The only action that is waived is a class action right. And what does Kinkle say? And Strand says the same thing. Is a class action is not a remedy. It is not a cause of action. It is a procedural right. And being a procedural right, you don't have to have substantive unconscionability in this case to decide on the class action waiver. Now, in Birch, which was another case by this court, that case had a home warranty that was provided to the customer, that was provided to the home buyer 4 months after they purchased the home. They also were given representations about that warranty that turned out to be not true or not the same that were in the actual warranty, and the arbitration clause that this court struck down was buried in a 31-page booklet. Here, you have a separate agreement that was entered into by the parties. And I'll tell you, the issue conspicuous as to where the agreement is, did they understand the agreement, and did they have a right to look at it, was it equal bargaining to it? This I brought with me. This is the actual retail sales contract. This is the agreement that the parties actually entered into. This is what it looks like. And if the court wants, I can pass it to your honors to take a look at it, because I think taking a look at the actual agreement is different than looking at the exhibits myself and counsel have provided in the documents, because the copies don't do it justice. This is as a real result, yes, of the one document. And everything is required to be in there that's stated in the statute. Now, had this arbitration agreement, not clause, but agreement, been shrunk down and placed somewhere into this agreement, the argument you would have heard from petitioners is, this is just like the Scott case. This is just like Iberia. This is just like Ting. They had this tiny little clause and nobody could understand or read, and it was stuck inside and it was inconspicuous. They signed the agreement because they saw their terms and conditions, the price of the vehicle, the warranty. They never even noticed. And that's the argument. That's the affidavit you would see, and we'd still be standing here today. The difference is you have an actual agreement that was entered into that's separate apart and is incorporated into this agreement. That is different and distinct from every single case we have heard from. With regard,
if I could ask you a question on that point. I'm not sure I read Scott to say that the agreement was, the waiver was stricken solely on unconscionability grounds. It looks to me like it also said, and separately, that as a matter of contract law, in dealing with these kinds of deceptive act, Trade Practice Act claims, that the waiver of the class action is not going to be enforced. That seems to me to be the gravamen of the exculpation discussion in the opinion. Isn't that a separate analysis beyond just the unconscionability analysis that we've adopted?
I think so. But I think the difference there in the Washington case is under their Washington Consumer Protection Act, they have a public policy that they've enacted that literally states to protect the public and foster fair and honest completion, and they felt that the waiver of the class action forestalled or vindicated those consumer rights. That's what they found in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And their public policy, they found it that the waiver violated that consumer right public policy by being in contrast or in conflict with that public policy.
So why should this court take a different tack in that analysis?
Because it doesn't. This contract here, this agreement, and what we're saying is, we're not saying that all per se class action waivers are conscionable. We're saying that this agreement is conscionable.
The analysis you recited, which I think is spot on, had to do with the legislature's declaration of public policy. Isn't our legislature's declaration of public policy concerning the collection of Deceptive Trade Practice Act problems the same?
It is. The policy is the same, but the analysis, I don't think, is – I don't agree with the analysis, number one, of the Washington court. And the other issue would be is that it does not limit those rights. Those rights are there. The right to sue all the time. The affidavits that were cited by counsel as to Dan Wolves and Joshua Landers, I've had cases against Dan Wolves on the Clark County Pro Bono Project involving deceptive trade practices on a vehicle. And so they have taken those cases. And had he gone to a hearing, and there was an evidentiary hearing, I would have enjoyed Dan Wolves on the stand and asking him about all the cases I've had against him regarding the Clark County Pro Bono.
It's just nothing like getting a fellow lawyer under a...
I would love it. I like Dan. I like Dan, and I would have had no problem asking Dan those questions, including Joshua Landers. I've had cases with him as well.
Did you ask for an evidentiary hearing in the district court?
I did not, Your Honor. We moved forward to compel arbitration. We submitted all the documents and felt that this speaks for itself.
They came forward with the affidavits, did you challenge the presentation of those affidavits? Did you object to them being presented?
We did. In our briefs, Your Honor, we argued that they were not evidence, that there was not testimony, they were not being deposed. They introduced their deposition testimony. They wanted to bring him, they would have to do it in another way.
That argument to Judge Denton?
Correct, Your Honor. Can't remember. I got to be honest. It's been a little while. I remember arguing that those affidavits were not expert testimony, and and that they did not provide actual evidence into the record. You know, and they never asked for an evidentiary hearing. I cannot remember if I asked and said that you have one first.
Thank you.
Colleagues, any other questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Dende.
I ran out of time. I didn't get a chance to address the one document rule. I apologize. And I do have that here at the court. I'd like to see the actual contract.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Blanche, you got about 3 minutes and 19 seconds left.
The charge that we are asking for a per se rule that all class action bans are always unconscionable and all arbitration clauses are always unconscionable is a red herring. That is not what we are asking for. That's not what any of the cases, not one of the cases that we've cited, have done. Instead, they have always looked at it on a case-by-case basis. What we are arguing is that the evidence in this case, where we had three affidavits, where they could have deposed these people. I've been in a series of cases in which we've come forward with these kinds of affidavits. We've come forward with testimony from legal aid, from consumer lawyers from the area, and the defendants.
Counsel, was there a specific ruling by Judge Denton as to those affidavits?
No. The court simply issued a five-sentence order granting the motion to compel arbitration. There's no reference to or comment upon the affidavits at all.
And outside of the order, in open court, did he make any comment?
My understanding is that they did not. So we do think that the evidentiary basis is what's key here, and that we had a great deal of evidence. There was no counter evidence on the other side. Mr. Wold is saying, when these cases come into legal aid, we can't find any lawyer to handle these cases, and we turn them down, and we have a consumer lawyer saying, we're familiar with the market, we know all the consumer lawyers in the state, and we know there's no one who I can refer this case to, that it's not what the evidence was in Strand. Now, in Strand, counsel brought up an important point. The Strand court made what I think is a wildly poor ruling of law when they said that because the class action ban is a procedural device, therefore it cannot be substantively unconscionable. They said, well, you know, substantive unconscionability only goes to things that strip you from, you know, directly strip you from rights. That is not a very appropriate unconscionability analysis. What the majority of courts have said that have looked at this is that where you have procedures which have the effect of gutting rights, that is just the same as having an explicit gutting of rights. The California Supreme Court on this was very specific. And the U.S. Supreme Court in the Randolph case said, the late Chief Justice Rehnquist said, that if an arbitration clause was prohibitively expensive, and expense is certainly a procedure, it's not a substantive issue, that would be grounds for not enforcing a clause. In the Discover Bank case, what they said was, procedures can have substantive effects. The ban on class action, I mean, if you had said that the arbitration can only take place on leap day in New Zealand at 3 a.m., you know, that would have been a procedure. It's a place and so forth, but it would have been exculpatory. It would have denied access to justice, and it would be something that the court would strike down.
In the California cases, wasn't there a statute that said an anti-waiver statute? Certainly in Ting there was.
Yes, and we won in the district court in that and felt great about it. And then the Ninth Circuit overturned that part of Ting and said that was preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act. But they upheld the part of Ting that said that the state law of unconscionability made something that would gut the statute unenforceable as a matter of state contract law. So we lost the statutory claim. The not anti-waiver provision of the Consumer Legal Remedies Act, I won that with Judge Zimmerman in the district court, and we lost it on appeal, but we still won the case.
Well, do you think that the Scott's declaration of public policy invalidity, independent of unconscionability, falls to the Ting analysis if you assume Ting is correct?
It does not, because the way we argued in Scott was very differently. We did not say that we won because of the language of the statute. We argued that there was a basic rule of contract law in the state that said that where a contract term would have the effect of gutting a statute, would have the effect of basically crossing a big line through people's statutory rights, that's unenforceable as a matter of contract law that would apply to all contracts. And so if you had to get something that gutted the statute that was an arbitration clause, it wouldn't be enforceable either. And it was different from in Ting, where we actually just stood up and said, hey, this violates the Consumer Legal Remedies Act. So we that was Scott was version 2.0 of the argument. We did better with it. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? All right. Counsel, thank you for the briefs. Thank you for your fine arguments today. This matter will stand submitted, and we'll stand in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.
All rise.